He did manipulate a much better price than $9,000 a mile, and when the fences were erected, he fulfilled the rest of his promise, for he knew where to locate real bargains in Audaz sheep, Sika deer, Mouflon rams, and 8 American elk. He astonished Morrison by also acquiring 9 ostriches and 6 giraffes. We won't allow anyone to shoot them, but they do add color to the place. When the animals began to arrive, often by air, Roy Bubb greeted each one as if it were a member of his family, showing it personally to the large, almost free fields in which it would roam. "Madam Eland, you never had it better in Africa than you're going to have it right here." From the start, it had been intended that when the exotics were well established, and this would come soon, for the Allerkamp Ranch was much like the more interesting parts of South Africa, from which the elands and other antelopes came, big game hunters would be invited to come and test their skill against animals in the wild. "Year after next," Roy Bubb said, "when we have the lodge fixed up, and my wife has hired some cooks, and I've got guides, we're in business." They would charge substantially for the privilege of killing one of their exotics, but as the pamphlet which Roy Bubb composed pointed out, "it's a danged sight cheaper coming to Allerkamp for your eland than going to Nairobi." Extremely practical where his own money was concerned, he established a rather high rate for the Texas hunters. Animal: axis deer, source, India. Our cost per pair of yearlings, $500. Our cost for the mature male, $850. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,800. Seek a deer from China. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $500. Our cost for a mature male, $850. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,200. A black buck from India. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $250. Our cost for a mature male, $850. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,100. A fallow deer from Germany. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $250. Our cost for a mature male, $450. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,000. Whitetail from the USA. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $450. Our cost for a mature male, $800. Hunter pays trophy size, $2,500. Red stag from Scotland. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $2,400. Our cost for a mature male, $3,800. Hunter pays trophy size, $6,650. An elk from the USA. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $3,500. Our cost for a mature male, $4,500. Hunter pays trophy size, $7,000. Audaz ram from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $360. Our cost for a mature male, $850. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,500. Corsican ram from Corsica. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $75. Our cost for a mature male, $100. Hunter pays trophy size, $250. Mouflon ram from Sardinia. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $380. Our cost for a mature male, $500. Hunter pays trophy size, $1,000. An eland from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $1,750. Our cost, mature male, $1,500. Hunter pays trophy size, $3,000. An ibex from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $3,500. Our cost for a mature male, $2,400. Hunter pays trophy size, $4,500. Horned oryx from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $3,500. Our cost for a mature male, $2,000. Hunter pays trophy size, $4,000. A gemsbok from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $5,000. Our cost for a mature male, $2,750. Hunter pays trophy size, $3,750. Zebra, Grants, from Africa. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $4,500. Our cost, mature male, $2,800. Hunter pays trophy size, $4,000. And Turkey, Wild, from the USA. Our cost for a pair of yearlings, $100. Our cost, mature male, $150. Hunter pays trophy size, $250. But when they were in place, with Morrison paying one bill after another for their purchase and their transportation, Roybub introduced a stunning addition, which he paid for out of his own pocket. One morning he called Houston with exciting news. "Todd, Maggie, fly right up. It's unique." When they reached the ranch, they found that a large trailer had moved in with animals of some kind. "You'll never guess," Roybub cried. The van was maneuvered to one of the smaller fields where hunting was forbidden, and when the gate was opened and men stationed so that the animals, when released, could not scamper back toward the trailer, ramps were placed, the door swung out, and down came a quiet, noble procession. The watchers gasped, for Roybub had acquired from an overstocked zoo four of nature's loveliest creations, sable antelope, big creatures as large as a horse, but a soft purplish-brown, a majestic way of walking, and the finest horns in the animal kingdom. When they felt themselves to be free, they sniffed the unfamiliar air, pawed at the rocky soil, so like their own in South Africa, then raised their stately heads and began moving away. When they did this, the observers could see the full sweep of their horns, those tremendous lyre-like curves that started at the forehead and turned backward in an imperial arch till the tips nearly touched their flanks. Almost as if they appreciated how grand and eloquent they were, they posed at the edge of a tree cluster, then leaped in different directions and lost themselves in the woodlands of their new home. Sometimes a whole month would pass without anyone seeing one of the sables. Then a visitor would be driving aimlessly along the ranch roads, and suddenly before him would appear that stately animal, purplish gold in the afternoon sun, with sweeping horns unlike any the traveler would have seen before, and he would come scrambling back to the lodge, shouting, "What was that extraordinary creature I saw?" And Roybub would ask, "Sort of purple, huge horns." And when the man nodded, he would say proudly, "That was one of our sables, glory of the Allerkamp. What would it cost me to shoot one? They ain't for shooting." During the early years of the Houston crises, no real estate people escaped the adverse effects. But since Maggie Morrison had always avoided the rental business, she did not suffer immediately from the collapse of petroleum prices. Associated with one of the solid firms, she continued to specialize in finding a few inexpensive homes for northern executives whose corporations had moved them into the Houston area. "I sometimes wonder who's running the store up there. All the bright vice presidents seem to be moving down here." She did not yet have the courage to do what her husband did so easily: put together a really big operation with outside financing from Canada or Saudi Arabia. But she was doing well and could have supported herself had she been required to do so. She had fallen into a Texas pattern of thought in which any gamble, if it had even a 40% chance of success, was worth the taking. "And anyway, Todd, if it all did collapse, we could start over as clerks in somebody's office and within 6 months own the place." That she was now a complete Texan manifested itself in two ways. In her letters home to her friends in Detroit, she no longer even spoke of returning. Something in Houston catches the imagination and sets it aflame. "Last week, I found a home for one of the most famous of the astronauts out at NASA east of here. For years he'd been saying, 'One of these days, I'll go back to Nebraska.' Last week, he bit the bullet and will be staying here even after retirement from the program. He has a little business going on the side." The thing that catches you, I think, is the dynamism of the place. It's like watching some great flywheel whirring about. In the first moments, you marvel at its speed, and then suddenly you find yourself wanting to be a part of it, and you're sorely tempted to jump in. Well, I've jumped. Would you believe it, Pearl? I've put together a deal for three Arabs involving some of the finer houses, $14 million, of which I hold on to a small part. Until I close, I'll be so nervous I won't sleep." That turned out to be a frightening one-week nightmare, which, when disposed of, she swore never to repeat. She took this oath because she had become aware that her husband frequently found himself in rather delicate positions, from which he extricated himself by moves which she supposed she would not have approved had she known the details. For example, when the oil man who had been their partner shifted from the ranch on the Pedernales to the hunting lodge in Scotland, he confided, "Maggie, I don't like to say this, but I'm very fond of you, and so is Rachel. Protect yourself. I've been in 4 financial deals with your husband, and damn it all, in every case he pulled some swifty. The Lambert development, the ranch at Falfortius, the airplane, out at Allerkamp. He cuts corners, he gigs his friends. He's always looking for that little extra edge, and that's one of the reasons why I'm switching my hunting to Scotland." Have his actions, have they been illegal? He intertwined his fingers until they formed a little cathedral. The line is tenuous, shady. When you deal with big numbers, you face big problems. But you must never gig your own associates. Certainly he's treated Roy Bubb fairly. The fact that she asked this as a question indicated that doubt had been sown. Roy Bubb's the best man in Texas. Everybody treats him fair. But even Roy Bubb had better watch out, because someday he's going to find he owns no part of that ranch. So long, Roy Bubb. Nice to have known you. I can't believe that. And you better watch out, Lady Meg, or you're going to be out on your keister with the rest of us. He did not see her again, and to her surprise, the dentist with the big kennel ignored her, too. So one day while she was surveying corner lots that might be converted into modest wraparounds, she stopped by the kennels and asked bluntly, "Did my husband have anything to do with your pulling out of the Allerkamp deal?" And he said frankly, "After a while, Maggie, men get fed up with dealing with your husband. Watch out." The second way in which Maggie indicated that Texas had captured her was the manner in which she adjusted to her daughter's strange behavior. Beth, a spectacular beauty in her late teens, had refused to attend the University of Michigan. "The only place I want to go is UT." "Stop using that nonsensical phrase. If you mean Texas, say so." "That's certainly what I mean." And at UT, she had become chief baton twirler. In disgust, Maggie had refused to attend any games. But one Saturday afternoon, when Texas was playing SMU, she chanced to see on the halftime television show a most remarkable young woman from the other university, a real genius at twirling. The SMU girl wore a skimpy costume that revealed her lovely grace, and she threw the baton much higher than Maggie would have believed possible, catching it deftly, now in front, now behind. "Extraordinary," Maggie said. As a girl, she had seen circus performers who were no better than this young artist, so she stayed by the television as her own daughter appeared for Texas. And what she saw made her catch her breath. When the SMU band and performers left the field, the mighty Texas band swung into action, more than 300 strong, dressed in burnt orange. In front came the 6'7" drum master, followed by 16 cheerleaders, men and women. After them came the 3 baton twirlers, with Beth Morrison in the middle. Behind her came the endless files of the musicians, all stepping alike, all inclining their cowboy hats in rhythm. At the rear came a couple of dozen drummers, cymbalists, glockenspiel players, and whatnots, followed by the sensation of the Texas campus, a drum so huge that 3 men were needed to keep it secured to its carriage and moving forward. It was taller than 2 men, and was clubbed by a player whose arm muscles were huge. Its deep, booming sound filled the stadium. And then Beth stood forth alone, this poet manque, and with a skill that staggered Maggie, she sent first 1, then 2 batons into the air, catching them unfailingly, and creating a kind of mystic spell for this important autumn afternoon. "Who in his right mind," Maggie asked aloud as she switched off the television, "would invent something like that spectacle and call it education?" But later, when she was forced to reconsider all aspects of the situation, she conceded that Mr. Sutherland, principal at Deaf Smith High, had been right when he predicted that Beth would find her life within the Texas syndrome and be very happy in it. Beth had been pledged by one of the premier sororities, the Kappas, whose senior members arranged for her to meet one of the more attractive BMOCs. Wolfgang McNabb, descendant of two famous Texas Rangers, was indeed a big man on campus, for he stood well over 6 feet, weighed about 220 lean pounds, and played linebacker on the Longhorn football team. He was 5 years older than Beth and should have graduated before she entered the university. But in the Texas tradition, he had been redshirted in both junior high school and college. That is, held back arbitrarily so that he would be bigger and stronger when he did play. He was a bright young fellow, conspicuous among the other football giants, in that he took substantial classes in which he did well. After their meeting in the Kappa Lounge, he and Beth studied together for an art appreciation seminar in which he excelled, and before long they were being referred to as that ideal Texas couple. What happened next was explained by Beth's mother in one of her periodic letters to Detroit. "What you Northerners never appreciate, Pearl, is that Texas is so big that you can live your life within its limits and never give a damn about what anybody in Boston or San Francisco thinks. A girl like our daughter Beth can enjoy a stunning life at the university here without giving a hoot what the social leaders at Vassar or Stanford think. Matrons here do not have to consider Philadelphia or Richmond. They're their own bosses. All that matters is how they're perceived in Dallas and Houston. A writer can build a perfectly satisfactory reputation in Texas, and he doesn't give a damn what critics in Kalamazoo think. His universe is big enough to gratify any ambition. Same with businessmen, same with newspapers, same with everything." I share these reflections because I've been thinking of Beth. She could have had a noble career at Michigan or Vassar, of that I'm sure. The kid's a near genius, and was a wonderful poet at 14 when the real poets start. But at her local high school, she was brainwashed into becoming a baton twirler, pom-poms, the bit. And when I challenged this, she said, "Let's face it, Mom, how could Texas produce a poet when its favorite food is chicken-fried steak smothered in white library paste?" She went her way, and damned if she didn't become the best baton twirler of the lot. Also a puffy, pretty sorority girl without a brain in her head, you know the type? So what happens to my adorable little nitwit? She marries one of the handsomest football players God ever made, and at their wedding his brother Cletus appears, 6 feet six, a full-fledged Texas Ranger with big hat and hidden gun holster. When the three of them stood before the minister, Baptist naturally, with little Beth in the middle and those two gorgeous hunks on either side, all I could do was hide my tears and recall the biblical quotation, "Male and female created he them." And then I got two real surprises. What do you suppose they did with the wedding purse her sorority and his fraternity contributed? They bought a Picasso print. Yep, those redneck hillbillies bought a Picasso. And this evening's news announces that Wolfgang has been drafted by the Dallas Cowboys, said to be the best football team in America. Surely it's better than Detroit. So I'm not to be the mother of a poetess, but the mother-in-law of a football hero, and I find myself shouting with the rest of Texas, "So who gives a damn about Vassar? The real world is down here." Of course, when the recession grew acute in 1982, and oil dropped to $29 a barrel, and the fall of the Mexican peso prostrated Houston real estate, threatening many of the big hotels with bankruptcy because those spectacular 10-room suites were no longer being rented to Mexican millionaires, even fortunately situated couples like the Morrisons began to feel pinches. Todd had only a vague awareness of the economic slump until he saw at the commuter airport the number of private planes that were suddenly for sale. This struck home, and he quickly convened a strategy session with his wife. Now's the time to make our big moves. "You must be crazy. The bottom's falling out." That's exactly when opportunities appear. A good real estate agent, and you're one of the best, Maggie, can make a bundle when the market is going up. But he can make even more when it's going down, because people have to sell, and there's damned few buyers around. How can we buy? Credit. We hawk everything we have. We look for distress bargains, and we buy it to the hilt. When they had done this and exhausted their own funds, Todd said, "The luscious plums, the real big ones, are beginning to ripen. Go up to Dallas and line up some real money." It was in this manner that Maggie Morrison, a one-time schoolteacher in a suburb of Detroit, fired during retrenchment, walked into the office of Ransom Rusk in Dallas, trying to interest him in a Houston real estate speculation requiring $143 million. In the first 8 minutes of their meeting, she learned much about Texas financing. "I apologize, Mr. Rusk, for coming at you like this when the papers say you've suffered reverses." And he laughed. "My dear Mrs. Morrison, it's precisely at such times that a man like me is looking for new ventures. Some of the old ones have worn thin." "Then you'll consider the deal?" And he said, "I've always been willing to consider any deal, if there's enough leverage. That's how I landed with Textech." She next asked, "How much would you expect my husband and me to throw in?" And he said, "Every nickel you have. I want you to be as concerned about this as I would be." Finally, he said, "You want $143 million. I'll put up $25 million if you put up $4 million. And she said, "But that leaves us more than $100 million short. Where do we get it?" And he said, "The banks. You'll be amazed at how eager they are to lend money to anyone with a hot idea, and yours is hot." She asked, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "Winning, losing, I care little about either, but I do like to be in the game." If one kept focusing attention on big ranchers like Lorenzo Quimper, or big oil men like Ransom Rusk, or big cotton growers like Sherwood Cobb, or real estate honchos like Todd Morrison, one might conclude that power in Texas was exerted only by those who controlled large sums of money. But this would be wrong. In many aspects of Texas life, it was the little folks from the fork in the creek who cast the deciding ballots. They kept racetrack gambling out of Texas, they allowed no state lotteries, and with refreshing frequency, they bullheadedly voted in a way that surprised the big cities. An excellent example of this strong-mindedness came in Larkin in 1980, when some misguided liberals reminded the town that one of its first occupants had been a respectable saloon-keeper and that alcohol had been outlawed only by the ill-conceived prohibition movement. "It's high time our town had stores that sold liquor and saloons in which law-abiding citizens could enjoy a sociable drink." Eager to put their money where their mouth was, these energetic people collected a huge war chest, hired Kraft and Killeen, the public relations firm from Dallas, and petitioned for a referendum. The war was on. Under Texas law, a county had the right to vote itself dry if a majority so desired, and out of 254 counties, 74 did. But there were so many ramifications that newcomers rarely understood what was happening. One county would outlaw everything, wine, beer, whiskey. Another would allow beer, but not wine or whiskey. And a third, fourth, and fifth would create their own mixes. As a result, only 36 counties were totally wet. After the wild years of the oil boom, Larkin had voted itself dry, and in both the 60s and 70s had repulsed efforts to rescind that law. "This town," boasted Reverend Craig, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Larkin, "is a haven of decency and sobriety in a state which has too many examples of the opposite character." Craig was a good clergyman, especially revered for his fatherly interest in orphans and his loving attention to elderly people without families. Much of the good that occurred in Larkin could be attributed to his acts, and wealthy oil men like Ransom Rusk kept him in funds sufficient to cover the numerous little charities he performed. He preached well, did not rant, was ecumenical toward the lesser churches that had crowded into Larkin, and had goaded his congregation into welcoming even Mexicans and blacks into the church if they were passing through. "Craig adds a touch of humanity and decency to our town," one of the oil men said when making his annual contribution, and this was the general opinion. Young people appreciated him because, in a willing effort to keep up with the times, he had encouraged his elders to allow dancing at church socials, a radical move when one recalled the old days. Craig was not a fanatic where morals were concerned, and he had several times helped prostitutes stranded by their pimps, for he suspected that Jesus would have done the same. And he served as a surrogate father for children who fell into trouble. But he could be remarkably forceful when discharging two of his Baptist obligations. He believed in a literal interpretation of the Bible, and he abhorred demon rum. "I have been forced to witness so much human tragedy resulting from alcohol that I stand in wonderment that any man would willingly allow this evil substance to pass his lips. And as for women who do so, they are anathema." He was in many respects the most powerful force in Larkin, and when one particularly offensive oil tycoon flouted all the implicit laws of North Texas, Craig preached such a powerful pair of sermons against him that he was in effect excommunicated, not only from the Baptist Church, but from the community as well. The miscreant moved to Dallas, where he was quite happy. It was largely due to Craig that Larkin remained dry, for it had been his vigorous leadership which had repelled the last two attempts to turn it wet, and he was now girding his loins to fight again. He chose to ignore the fact that a large majority of his flock enjoyed a short snifter now and then, but he did frequently praise his congregation for hiding no outright drunks in its membership. He was contemptuous of those Rio Grande counties which, because of their heavily Hispanic population, refused to outlaw alcohol. And in his more inflammatory prohibition sermons, he sometimes referred to them as our southern cousins to whom drunkenness is a way of life, refusing to acknowledge that their orderly use of beverages produced less actual drunkenness than did Larkin's severe code. Of course, under the complex Texas system, anyone who wanted a drink could find one, and each dry county contained its quota of enthusiastic topers, because the law contained a built-in weakness which drinkers were quick to take advantage of. A respectable county like Larkin could vote itself dry, while its more disreputable neighbor remained stubbornly wet. And since most counties, especially in the West, were small and square, something like 30 miles to a side, with the county seat dead center, it was possible for a town at the heart of a dry county to be only 15 miles from a flowing source of liquor. In Larkin's case, the distance from bone dry to sopping wet was 12 miles down Highway 23 to Bascom County, that notorious and nauseous sink of sin, as Reverend Craig liked to describe it in his sermons. When officials at the Larkin County Courthouse announced that a referendum had been authorized for the spring of 1980, Craig looked with awe at the forces arrayed against him and told his deacons, "Brethren, this is the fight that will determine the character of our county for the rest of this century. Look at those who assault us, all the distilleries of America, all the breweries of Texas, all the saloon keepers of those wet Red River counties, Kraft and Killeen of Dallas. Brother Carnwath, please tell the gentlemen the size of the war chest we face." A tall, thin man with deep-set eyes and a lock of hair that fell across his brow rose. "We have good reason to believe that they have amassed more than $700,000 to crush us, for they know that if they can bring their whiskey in here, they can lug their barrels into any county." "Gentlemen," Craig said, "the battle lines are drawn. Once more it is David against Goliath, and once more God will favor the pure in heart, puny though we may seem at the start." It really was little David against the forces of darkness. But the shepherd boy was by no means powerless, for Craig organized groups on three levels. It really was little David against the forces of darkness, but the shepherd boy was by no means powerless, for Craig organized groups on three levels. The sages of the community, children for a decent Texas, and in the middle, a large and forceful group, the watchdogs of the fort. With all the skills remembered from former battles, he brought pressure to bear on the editor of the Larkin Defender, who, if left alone, might have sided with the liquor people on three solid grounds, which he espoused privately to his friends. Orderly sale would be good for trade. Keeping our kids at home would stop those car crashes when they go seeking booze. And I hate the hypocrisy of drinking wet and voting dry. But when he found that his larger advertisers ardently supported Reverend Craig, even though they were themselves heavy drinkers, he found himself compelled to write a series of hard-hitting editorials favoring retention of the ban. To one outsider, the situation in Larkin seemed paradoxical. Everyone in this crazy town drinks, but wants to stop anyone else from doing so. An explanation of this curious Texas trait was spelled out in a letter written by a Baptist woman to a friend in New Mexico. It is true that Albert takes a small drink now and then, but only socially when we are in the homes of those who favor alcohol. Even I am not above a congenial nip on holidays, and I'm told that boys in school, and especially the older ones who work in town, drink somewhat. Yet all of us who have the vote prefer to keep alcohol out of the stores and saloons off our quiet streets. We do this, I think, because we know that to restrain evil in even the smallest degree is good, in that it sends a signal through the community that we shall not allow it to run rampant. On the three nights prior to the vote, Reverend Craig will hold prayer meetings in which we will commit ourselves to fighting the devil, for we are convinced that unrestricted use of alcohol is a principal agency through which he attacks individuals and their communities. The crusade against alcohol, which had to be fought repeatedly in what Reverend Craig called our Christian counties of the North, produced one grave weakness, which the people of Larkin did not like to discuss. Highway 23, leading to Bascom, became a well-traveled route, and when young men and women roared south to get liquored up, often drinking out of their bottles as they weaved their way back, there were apt to be accidents, more coming north than going south. And there were many involving some solitary drunk heading north who smashed head-on into some innocent car coming south with its four sober passengers. Tragedy in Suicide Gulch became the headline. And often it was the four sober travelers who were killed, while the solitary drunk survived because he had sped into the accident completely relaxed. Rarely did a year pass without some horrendous accident along Highway 23, and occasional protests appeared in the press about this nasty habit of young people driving down to Bascom to buy their liquor and then guzzling it on their way home. But no one seemed to blame the carnage in Suicide Gulch on Larkin's lack of orderly places in which to buy a drink. So, as the critical vote approached, the lines were drawn in typical North Texas fashion. Outside forces pouring in huge sums in hopes of being allowed to peddle their product. The Baptists fighting valiantly to maintain the status quo they had inherited from their God-fearing parents. Partisans on each side were sensible and patriotic and driven by respectable motives. But there was such enmity between them that no meeting ground could ever be established. Watchers of the campaign refused to predict how this one was going to result. Can't never tell the effect of all that money on their side or prayers on ours. A peculiarity of the Texas system was that any plebiscite on booze was effective for only a few years, after which the other side could try again. Ordinarily, the losers licked their wounds for about 6 years before storming back. But regardless of the outcome, it was never final. As Reverend Craig said 5 days before the vote, "In this world of sin, the forces of evil never rest." This year, it looked as if evil would triumph, for its Dallas managers, Kraft and Colleen, had run a masterful campaign, focused not on alcohol, but on human rights and the advantages of a free society. But at almost the last moment, the Drys received help from an unexpected quarter. In the oil town of San Angelo, 170 miles to the southwest, a Catholic priest named Father Euchre awoke to the fact that during the past 12 months, he had been required to conduct burial services for 5 impetuous young men of his congregation who had been shot and killed during 5 different drunken brawls on church property. In anguish over such mayhem, he had, with considerable publicity, announced that he would no longer rent his parish hall for any dance or entertainment at which liquor was consumed. He said that this would cost his church more than $3,000 in lost fees, but he felt that this would be a small price to pay if it would halt or even slow down the carnage. Father Euchre ended his announcement with a paragraph which somewhat dampened its effect among the Larkin Baptists, but even so, they clutched at the support his action provided. We are fairly certain that Jesus himself enjoyed the wedding feast at Cana, which certainly included wine and dancing. We believe that wine is also a part of God's creation, and therefore it is good. We believe that dancing can be very wholesome recreation. We categorically deny that drinking and dancing are evil of themselves, but it seems to be impossible at this time and in this place to conduct public dances with the abuse that alcohol brings. This tragic news from San Angelo that 5 young men in 1 small parish had died of gunshot wounds, plus Reverend Craig's imaginative use of the report, neatly ignoring the priest's reminder that he was not a prohibitionist, swung just enough votes to the Drys to ensure that, once again, Larkin County had obeyed the voice of its religious leader. When the vote was announced, church bells rang, and some members of the various congregations, including the pastor's 16-year-old son, rode through the county seat, tooting their horns in celebration of the victory. The other 3 youngsters in the car containing young Craig were so jubilant that when the informal parade in town ended, they rode joyously down Suicide Gulch to the grog shops of Bascom County, drank immoderately, and then came zigzagging homeward with 2 bottles of Old Alamo, 1 for the front seat, 1 for the back. As they approached the intersection of Highway 23 and FM 578, the driver became confused by the lights coming at him from dead ahead and by those angling in from 578. In a moment of supreme confidence, he decided to thread his way right through the middle. Instead, he smashed broadside into the car coming from the right. The driver, young Craig, the other 2 passengers, and the husband and wife in the other car were killed. Not instantly, but in the flames which engulfed them. The changes which assaulted Texas affected everyone. On the day before the regent's meeting, the new governor called the Quimper Ranch. "Lorenzo, the new regent I appointed is flying up from the valley. You've been a regent for 2 terms. Would you please meet him at the airport and more or less explain how things work?" The new man was Simon Garza, the thoughtful mayor of Bravo, and the first Hispanic to be appointed to the university's board of regents. Quimper, who had always employed Mexican wetbacks on his 9 ranches, and who had promoted one of them, Candido Guzman, to general foreman, found no difficulty in talking with Mayor Garza, brother of the A&M member of the task force with whom he had argued so congenially. It was a thoughtful conversation, because Garza immediately showed his desire to learn, and, faced with that sincerity, Il Magnifico realized that he must not clown around with his redneck humor. "You do us honor joining the regents, Mayor Garza. You've built a fine reputation throughout Texas." When Garza looked down at his hands to avoid having to respond to this formal flattery, Quimper said, "Being a regent is a privilege, one of the most important assignments in Texas. And I'm honored to be the first Mexican-American, although I do think it's about time, seeing how many of our people attend the place." "I'm glad to have you aboard," Quimper said. And when Garza asked, "Wasn't your father the famous regent?" Lorenzo was encouraged to speak with him as a serious equal. He had the job for years, and people either exalted or despised him, depending on whether or not they could read. When Garza smiled at the joke, Lorenzo grew more specific. My father did everything practical to promote the university football team, and everything possible to annihilate any influences he felt were not in harmony with the spirit of the gridiron. On the positive side, he created generous scholarships for football players, initiated the plan of having wealthy ranchers contribute steers to feed his athletes at their training table, and organized a fleet of private planes, some of them jets, which the dozen coaches could use when recruiting in the fall and winter months. He also provided, out of his own oil money, two different sets of uniforms for the 334 members of the university's show band of the Southwest, biggest and best in the nation, and twice as big as anything in Europe or Asia, he said. On crisp October days, when the Texas football team ran onto the field in the enlarged stadium he had helped provide, and the band marched out to greet them, he could sit back in his special box and think, "I'm responsible for a hell of a lot of that." And when boys he had recruited swept to national championships, he could say truthfully, "I brought most of that backfield to Texas. What a bargain." "Why is your father's name so familiar?" Garza asked. And Quimper said frankly, "Bad publicity," and he explained. There was a negative side. My father practically destroyed the faculty, disciplining anyone he disliked and firing those he distrusted. At the height of his reign of terror, he told me, "Running a university is like running a ranch. The man with money owns it, and he hires a manager and assistants. He gives them wide latitude in day-to-day operations, but he never lets them forget who's really in charge." He had an interesting theory about professors. "I like to have colorful men on my staff, fellows who wear old-fashioned clothes, or who go to northern Sweden in their summers, or who wear string ties. Makes the campus distinctive. But I do not want them meddling in the running of the place or speaking out on politics." Teachers who ignored his rules or openly contested them did not last long on my father's academic ranch. What was that famous fracas about Frank Doby? Quimper seemed to ignore the question, for he launched instead into a philosophical discussion about the arts in Texas. Compared to the other southern states, Texas has not produced its quota of artists, musicians, novelists, or philosophers, and my old man was one of the reasons. If we did not have world-class intellectuals, we did have, in my early days, two men who were building a foundation, and my father scorned them. Walter Prescott Webb had a fine, clear vision of the West, and wrote about it with skill and passion. But he favored liberal causes, and for my father that was forbidden. Frank Doby? What a man! Traipsed about the campfires, gathering cowboy yarns and tall stories about coyotes, longhorns, and rattlesnakes. I knew him and loved him. He could be as gentle as a hummingbird, as mean as a scorpion. He defined our state in terms of its rural heritage and made us proud of what we had accomplished. "Did Doby ever write anything of national importance?" Garza asked. And Quimper snapped, "He did a damned sight better. Carried the culture of Texas overseas to Cambridge University, where he was a star. But he also had strong feelings about the long-term welfare of the state, and that infuriated my father. I remember him roaring one night, 'Until we get rid of that communist some-bitch Frank Doby, we'll never have a safe university.'